Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your body.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Karen Reed back in court again today, and we're going to take you right there for all of the coverage of what's going on in that courtroom and the follow-ups with Judge Beverly Cannone. Let's go there right now.
The defense takes issue with Dr. Welcher providing an opinion that the lacerations and cuts are consistent with the geometry and orientation of the right taillight. There has been many claims about alternative sources, which the Commonwealth disagrees with, as to those abrasions. But if you've seen the PowerPoint that's been presented and provided to the court, will be presented to the jury, it shows the symmetry of the arm and the location of the arm, the height of the broken taillight, and it shows with great continuity the height, location of that broken taillight, and how it relates to a bent arm. And that is based on engineering, biomechanics, the same things that Archer employs. They just didn't do this. And so that's not witness testimony. That's not beyond the bounds of anything. That is powerful evidence, and we intend to introduce that. And then, as I mentioned, finally, the drop test. This is the same information that ARCA proposes in their report. For some reason, I don't think that was offered as evidence at trial, but it's clearly within the bailiwick of this expert. And so we will file on Monday a PowerPoint presentation redacting all the inadmissible parts of it, which is witness statements. And we expect to present the demonstrations to support the opinions as corroborative evidence of those opinions rather than just naked opinions. And there will be no trial by ambush. Now, we will be studious in getting that information to the defense. We would like them to be as studious getting us the ARCA information. It does concern me delaying that information because, as Attorney Alisi eloquently said, you need time to prepare. We know he's a very prepared attorney. We'd like to prepare as well, and if we wait to get records and information and know who wrote what part of the report, we won't be prepared. There's a third engineer in their team that wasn't called. We'll have to add him to the witness list if he has any relevance. We won't know until we question those witnesses. So I think I'm also inclined to ask the court to consider we have that questioning well before their testimony. But we will meet our commitment and provide those slides on Monday.
All right. And Mr. Alessi, again, you've already said you agree to talk to Mr. Brennan about the reciprocal discovery.
Yes.
Okay.
May I be heard?
Sure.
Thank you.
Like with Dr. Welcher's report, what Attorney Brennan did not say is even more important than what he did say moments ago. He didn't state or even address where is the methodology employed by Dr. Welcher tethered to a study, the scientific literature. He kept using the phrase, it's science and data. Quote, someone alleging that it's science and data doesn't even begin to approach that the methodology is established in the literature or satisfies the Dalbert-Lanigan factors. So, Your Honor, on the record before you, there's no better evidence that that tethering doesn't exist than the absence now for the fourth time upon challenge of that in Attorney Brennan's comments. That dooms Dr. Welcher. Now I want to address the false equivalency argument of Attorney Brennan. Attorney Brennan said falsely just now that the ARCA report does not set forth the methodology. There are 14 footnotes in the ARCA report. I just looked at them again. Footnotes 1, 2, and 3 tether the methodology of the ARCA experts to the literature. The methodology is documented. I do not understand how an attorney can get up and say a report doesn't have something without having a basis for saying it on a key issue that is disputed. Attorney Brennan also falsely stated that ARCA did exactly what Dr. Welcher did with regard to medicine and medical issues. That is completely false. ARCA, as is clear as day from the report, and I'll repeat it, did a force net equals mass time acceleration calculation and said the forces that come from 50 miles an hour, 24 miles an hour, and then so the unknown is the force, the F in the calculation. What is known is the M and the A. The M is the mass of the head and the mass of the arm. The mass of the head is 11 pounds. The mass of the arm is 11 pounds. You then take the acceleration theory, even assuming the theory of the Commonwealth, which we can test, which is it's 15 miles per hour or 24 miles per hour. You multiply the mass times the acceleration, and you get a force. And then they said this force it is expected to cause or not cause these types of injuries. That is a proper biomechanical engineering analysis. The ARCA experts didn't get into pattern recognition with regard to the wounds, the orientation, etc. But most importantly, there is no equivalency between what ARCA did and what Dr. Welcher did. With regard to Mr. Brennan stating, quote, this is what he does, referring to Dr. Welcher. The question is not, is this what he does? The question is what he does rooted in science. And what it means is not just any science, it has to be a commonly accepted, his methodology commonly accepted or satisfying the Dalbert factors. And Mr. Brennan did not contest one aspect. He didn't say, Your Honor, here is where what Dr. Welcher did can be found. It's commonly accepted, either in court opinions, which the court could take judicial notice of, or in peer-reviewed literature, because it's not there. And with regard to the five non-exclusive Dalbert factors, I covered that in my presentation in the beginning. I'm not going to repeat it, only to say that Mr. Brennan didn't address any of those five factors to show a proper foundation for that. With regard to what Mr. Brennan called arm experiment, relating to a bent arm, relating to injuries, I understand what Dr. Welcher did. The question's not what did he do, but is it accepted in the medical literature? So with regard to the arm experiment that Mr. Brennan just went through, he talked about it, but he didn't mention once where that's rooted in the literature. He finally concluded by saying, this is within the bailiwick of Dr. Welcher. I don't know what this is, but bailiwick is a tautology. It doesn't say anything about whether what he did is rooted in the literature or that it satisfies the Daubert factors. So, in conclusion, Your Honor, I go back to Rintala, I go back to Meeks, I go back to Case of Caravan. The Commonwealth has not today, not before, this is their fourth time, has not satisfied what the Supreme Judicial Court requires in these instances. And what it has come down to is the defendants, which stands in a different position. This equivalency between ARCA, I've shown, and it's easily documented, the court can see it, that contrary to Attorney Brennan's false statements, ARCA did cite to and tether their methodology to the literature. But when you have a defendant on trial for the seriousness of the charges here, to have no methodology, to have no tethering to the literature, that's, as Your Honor knows, the gatekeeper's function to stop that, those opinions from going to the jury, to ensure not what the defense has created, but what the Supreme Judicial Court has created, which is the purpose is to allow for cross-examination and a fair trial. They haven't satisfied their burden. They have the preponderance of the evidence burden. And the consequences should be borne by the Commonwealth, not the defendant.
Okay. Go ahead, I'll hear a quick response.
Regrettably, I know Attorney Alisi has decided to join the fray of disparagement. Now, he has said three times that I've made false statements. This isn't the first time that Mr. Alessi has tried to portray the Commonwealth as being disingenuous, because they know full well this is being covered by the media, and they want to create a sense to dehumanize anything that they don't like, whether it's the government, the prosecution, the witnesses, or the evidence. There's no place for it. Three times. This follows when he made representations, reckless representations in court, that Brennan lied 10 times. We found some of those transcripts, and I took enough dignity not to mention it, because I didn't think I needed to, that the transcripts were not even accurate. Mr. Alisi was actually wrong when he was claiming I was lying about reading reports. Now, I don't want to stand up here and have a dispute, but when you use words like false statements as an officer of the court, they better be supported. That is a strong statement to repeatedly make, and it's a tactical one. It's purposeful. Attorney Alisi is joining the fray, and that is all part of the strategy here. Now, if you look at page 13 and 14 of Dr. Welch's report, perhaps that was missed in the review, there are resources in that report that number 26 different items of resources. And so if we're talking about support and tethering, it is at the end of the report. It's not footnoted like ARCA, it's at the end of the report. It's all there.
All right, thank you. So we're going to move on to try and get some motions in quickly. The motion regarding the chalks, is there an objection to the Commonwealth's motion requesting the use of chalks and directing both parties to provide visual presentations and chalks prior to using?
No objection.
Okay, thank you. 583. Is there an objection to the Commonwealth's motion in limine to allow the expert Celebrite demonstration? We had it before. Is there an objection to that from the defense?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Is this something that can be done quickly, or is this something you need more time on?
15 to 20 minutes, Your Honor.
All right, so we're going to have to table this. We may end up coming back tomorrow.
I can do it unless you tell me what you're on.
Let's see what we can get before the luncheon break. The paper number 585, it's the Commonwealth's number 11. Motion in limine to admit the victim's out-of-court statements relating to John O'Keefe's state of mind, the Qualls, Bins types of cases. So is there an objection from the defense on that? If there is, I'll hear quickly from the Commonwealth on its motion.
There is, Your Honor.
Okay, so I'll hear you on this, Mr. Brennan.
Evidence of Mr. O'Keefe's state of mind is particularly relevant in this case. In addition to the charges, this has a domestic aspect to the case. We know from his statements that he was in a relationship with the defendant. We know from the statements that there was a tumult in that relationship, and many of those statements are reduced to writing. The state of mind of Mr. O'Keefe is reflected in those statements. There was no time or reason to fabricate. You can tell by the content and the volume of them that there is a legitimacy to them. And it is clear, based on that and other testimony, that he was in the course of attempting to end the relationship with Ms. Reed. And so his statements, especially over the course of the day of this incident.
All right, so what's the time frame? So over the course of the day, I realize that the Aruba incident is too remote and you're not using that, but what's your time frame for me to be able to evaluate this?
As far as his messages, I will
or the statements or the evidence that you're trying to put in under this doctrine.
His niece would testify, as she did in the last trial, about the tumult in the relationship.
Okay.
And we'd introduce the same text messages that we introduced at the last trial, reflecting Mr. O'Keefe's state of mind about the relationship.
Okay.
And there would be nothing different from the last trial other than the fact that we are not going to pursue the Aruba information. So it has actually a narrower time window than before.
Okay. All right, I'll hear you, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I may be a little more brief given that explanation by Mr. Brennan than I intended or anticipated. I will say that where the Commonwealth's motion fails is in its explanation as to the relevancy and how it comes in under a state of mind theory. These are obviously hearsay statements. In some cases, they are multiple hearsay statements. Or potentially multiple hearsay statements. John O'Keefe's state of mind is irrelevant unless there is some specific admissible evidence that he communicated those statements, and we'll have to sort of take them as they come, given I don't have the full breadth or an understanding of the full breadth of the information that is being sought. Mr. Brennan just indicated it's going to be consistent with the last trial, so that gives me some target range. But without knowing more, under a normal hearsay and or even state of mind analysis, it's irrelevant unless there's a specific admissible point that he communicated that, or point at which he communicated that state of mind to Ms. Reed. She was aware of his state of mind and, very importantly, that the information that was communicated to her was of such a nature that she would have acted on it in a manner that's consistent
right,
that's
what we were talking about, the Bins, Qualls, those points
correct.
That need to be made.
And that's what I'm getting to. With that last point, and to drive this point home, that's preposterous. The idea... There is no evidence to support that last point that this type of information, let's say, for instance, it's information that he wanted to break up with her, or he was mad at her, or he was angry at her about something, some incident, some specific thing having to do with feeding the kids donuts or not feeding the kids donuts, or they had what was considered and what was testified to in the first trial as a very normal row or argument about something as insignificant as that. The fact is, the state of the evidence is that on the night in question, it's uncontroverted by even the Commonwealth that the two of them were getting along extraordinarily well. The facts are borne out in both videos that are uncontested. They're borne out in witness statement that went uncontested, that they were affectionate, they were happy together. They were described by basically everyone on the the Albert side, the McCabe side, as well as individuals who also saw, that were not related to those families, who also saw Karen and John interacting throughout the evening. And they all said that they were getting along very, very well. One person described them, the court may remember this phrase, as lovey-dovey. I think that it's pretty clear that through this testimony, or through this rubric of bringing in John O'Keefe's state of mind, the Commonwealth really wants an opportunity to call one or more or several witnesses who will basically say he wanted to break up with her, or she was not a good girlfriend, he didn't like her. That is an assassination of her character. You couch it in whatever terms he wants, but that's really what it is. These witnesses will have no corroboration, we expect. I'm leaving the text messages aside. If there are text messages between John O'Keefe and Karen Reed, that may be a different analysis, but certainly where it comes down to the witnesses, like the niece, they'll have no corroboration or no documents, no writings, no recordings, no videos, no audios, nothing but their word. And to allow a witness to walk in and to say negative things about Miss Reed with no way of verifying those statements is highly prejudicial. It's not just prejudicial. It's far more prejudicial than it would ever be probative in this circumstance. Even if he did, even if the evidence was that he had discussed breaking up with other people, there are two major impediments to the Commonwealth's request. First, there is no evidence that, for instance, from the niece, I don't believe that there will be evidence, that was imparted, or those specific conversations were imparted to Miss Reed. The state of the facts very clearly show the opposite. If we look at the circumstantial evidence, the videos of Miss Reed at both C.F. McCarthy that night, as well as at the waterfall that night, showed the two of them getting along, completely inconsistent with two people who were talking about breaking up. John O'Keefe wanting to dump her and her knowing that she was going to be dumped, which is what the Commonwealth is generally suggesting. And second, there's absolutely no evidence that even if she thought that John O'Keefe, if she was aware that John O'Keefe was unhappy in the relationship, that he might want to break up or in the relationship, that that would have been a catalyst for murder. And that's where the rubber meets the road in this analysis. That's what the Commonwealth has an obligation to prove before this evidence is admissible. And it's a ridiculous stretch. They'd been together for about 2 years, notwithstanding the prior relationship many years earlier. She had her own career. Karen Reed had her own money. She had her own life. She had her own job, had her own house. She was not dependent upon John for anything, not for money, not for room and board, nothing. They were, at the end of the day, just dating. The fact that she had some text messages with other individuals, or an other individual, Higgins, is actually evidence that she knew she had options, and John O'Keefe likely knew he had options as well. Both of these individuals were not tethered to each other in a way that if one wanted to break up with the other one, one was going to murder the other one. And that's what the Commonwealth would have to prove to make this admissible. There's no suggestion in the facts that Karen Reed would kill John O'Keefe rather than simply break up with him or allow him to break up with her, and they both go on their own way. It's absurd. And there's no evidence that she was angry with him that night before she got out of her SUV. All of the evidence that we have, all of the uncontroverted evidence that we have, establishes exactly the opposite. They were a loving couple out one evening, having drinks with friends, in a good mood, and happy with one another. We cite a case called McGraw, M-A-G-R-A-W. And just for the record, I'll state the site. I think it's at 426 Mass 589. And the McGraw court provided a very defined quote that I think is illustrative for our purposes, Your Honor. Quote, a murder victim's state of mind may be material to the defendant's motive, but only if the defendant knew of the victim's state of mind, and most importantly, the court's words, not mine, and most importantly, would be likely to respond to it. The best evidence that this second prong cannot be met is the fact that the Commonwealth will attempt to bring in these prior statements of John, which, if believed, Ms. Reed never acted on. In other words, they're going to bring in prior statements to say she would necessarily act on it and act on it in a violent way that would take someone's life. But at the same time, they're stuck with the very clear fact that if, in fact, that's true and it was imparted to her that he was unhappy in the relationship, she never acted on it, not once. And the moment that we do have frozen in time that we can go look back on is the night of January 29th, or the evening of January 28th, going into the early morning hours of January 29th, in which they were both getting along perfectly well, completely in opposite of what the court in McGraw defines as necessary for that sort of evidence to be admissible. The reason that the Commonwealth's theory for admission doesn't make sense is because it's not really their theory for admission, I suspect. I suspect that it's more that they would like to have someone or some people get on the witness stand and assail Miss Reed's character, make her look bad, and say that she was either a bad girlfriend or that John was not happy with her. It's an attempt to inflame the jury, to make them dislike her for something that has nothing to do with the evidence that she hit him with her SUV on the night in question. And it's a very transparent attempt. We strongly believe that this attempt does not meet the evidentiary standards that are required. The Commonwealth cannot meet those standards, and pursuant to McGraw and its progeny, we would ask that this evidence be deemed inadmissible.
Okay. Quick follow-up.
It seems the thrust of the defense argument, and I appreciate their advocacy and argument, but it's not shared by the Commonwealth, is that they were lovey-dovey and got along well that night. Well, at the time of this incident, it seems there's substantial evidence that Ms. Reed was not happy with Mr. O'Keefe. On 2020, transcript page 43, line 1, she was asked, would you say that you were angry with John that night? Her answer was yes. She was asked by Ms. Voss on June 20th, 2023, about that night, or the day before, and she says, I was temporarily frustrated, it wasn't an argument. She also says to Ms. Voss, were you worried at him or pissed at him or both? I was pissed until I fell asleep. Now, in addition to her anger, she specifies some of the tension. We heard from the testimony of Jen McCabe that when she gave directions to John O'Keefe, she mentioned a mother of a child who Mr. O'Keefe had a prior relationship with. That this is minutes before we allege the collision happened. And so in the interviews that she has provided to these different outlets, she discusses the fact that she hears this information and that there was an issue or some type of interaction about the fact that he was previously dated another woman. And this is a conversation that takes place minutes before the collision. And so we have statements from the defendant herself that show the discord in the relationship, the anger, being pissed, the motive. Without reading them, because it's unnecessary, there is substantial corroborative evidence. Not only that the text messages, which are corroborated by the niece's testimony, but the imminency of it, that this is happening in real time, moments before John O'Keefe's death. And so all of this should be admissible. It's all supportive of each other.
Your Honor, if I could just correct the record very quickly.
Sure.
If anything Mr. Brennan just said was true, he might have an argument. My goodness. It's important to get some of the facts right. You got to get some of them right. The conversation that he just referenced with Jen McCabe was the next day. It was the next morning. Not minutes before the collision. He's read the transcript. Every time he stands up, he says, I've read the transcript. I wasn't there. I've read the transcript. We got to hold him to that burden, Your Honor. You got to get the facts right. That conversation with Jen McCabe was the next morning after John O'Keefe had been found, after he didn't come home.
I'm
sorry. I just need to correct.
I'm sorry. I was talking to my client real quick. I'm not quite done. This was during the time after 5:07, after the SUV leaves, we see One Meadows, and Jim McCabe and Kerry Roberts get together, and as they're looking for them, as they're looking for him and searching for him, that's the point at which they have the conversation about being, some other woman, or why he might not have come home, or what her mindset might have been at the time. It's after the fact, well after the fact. The other issues concerning Karen Reed's statements about being upset, or in Gretchen Voss's words, were you pissed at him? It was in context of when. When were you upset with him? When he didn't come back out. When he didn't come back to the car. After she left, she was angry. That's where all the voicemails take place. That's what she was talking about, having been angry. There is no evidence, none whatsoever, no evidence in the record. I want to make this as crystal clear as I can. No controverted evidence, no suspect, no evidence at all that John O'Keefe and Karen Reed had a single crossword that night before he ended up missing and she went home. Before he ended up walking out of the car, going toward the house, and she ended up leaving when he didn't come back out. Zero. The only evidence that was propounded throughout that entire day was hours and hours earlier that morning dealing with, did you feed the kids donuts? And yeah, I did. You know, I don't like it when you feed the kids donuts. She was spoiling the kids. It was not enough to enrage anybody. It's ridiculous. And the evidence that it didn't enrage anybody is the fact that they ended up later that night together in a lovey-dovey environment, getting along fine, getting along wonderfully. That's why the Commonwealth cannot make their burden to establish that this was the type of information that she would have, by necessity, acted on, and not just acted on in any way, acted on in a way that's consistent with their theory that she would have received the information and murdered him for it. That's the hurdle over which the Commonwealth cannot leap for the admissibility of this type of evidence. It's far, far more prejudicial than it is probative.
Okay.
Before accusing somebody of getting it wrong, the person accusing should be right. I know that Mr. Jackson, Attorney Jackson, was present during the Voss interviews, but apparently they haven't listened to the interviews or read the transcripts. Page 88, line 22. Not the next morning. When Jen was navigating John to the Alberts, she said it's near Ashley's house. Ashley and John had hooked up prior to John and I dating. Similarly, page 92, line 1, totally contrary to what you just heard. Totally. There was a woman who was a mother to kids that were close to John's kids who lived very close to the Alberts. In fact, when Jen was navigating John to the Alberts, when I was driving, she said it near Ashley's house. Ashley and John had hooked up prior to John and I dating. She broke up briefly with her husband. Not my words.
All right. So we're going to break. We've got a lot of ground to still cover. I suggest that we take the personal attacks completely out of this. Hold on. Both sides. I want to get through these motions today. If we don't, I'll bring you back tomorrow. I'll bring you back Monday. Let's get through these motions. Leave all the attacks, all the falsehoods, all of that. Leave it all aside. Let's focus on the motions and get through this. So I'll see everybody at 2 o'clock.
Your Honor, if I could say one more thing. As the court ponders this last issue.
I'm not even thinking about it for the next hour. Let's leave it.
And that is the latest from the courtroom and the hearing of Karen Reed today. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our conversations about this case, the hearings, and more. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, guys. Here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil. Next, I take an ice bath. Ooh, feeling super healthy.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.